Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 5 years after the recent financial crisis, the banking system is dominated by six too-big-to-fail institutions. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. These banks are even bigger than they were before the crash. They collectively hold $9.4 trillion in assets. That's more than twice the annual spending budget of the U.S. government. The federal government's response to the financial crisis has been to inject public funds into the banking system to control the crisis. But some argue that we could face another crisis because these powerful financial institutions have been able to water down any meaningful reform. And they know that if we have another crash, they will most likely be bailed out again. So what are the alternatives to this system and how viable are they? One alternative is public banking. North Dakota is currently the only state in the country with a public banking system, but 20 states are currently considering some form of state banking legislation. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about public banking. What is it exactly? How does it work? And what kind of alternative would it provide? How would it affect local communities? From June 2nd to the 4th, a public banking conference will be held in San Rafael. The conference will focus on how to reclaim the economy from Wall Street with public banking. And joining us today is Mark Armstrong. He's executive director of the Public Banking Institute, a nonprofit that was formed in January 2011 to facilitate the implementation of public banking at all levels. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Rose. Glad to be on your show.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Timothy Canova. He's professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you. So before we dive in and talk about public banking, I wanted to talk with both of you about where we are today, 5 years after the crisis. It's kind of amazing that this doesn't get more attention. I mean, you've got people like New York Times economic columnist Gretchen Morgenson, who writes about this regularly. And she recently told Bill Moyers that most of these banks are not getting any smaller. In fact, they're getting larger. So, Mark, why don't we start off with you? 5 years after this crisis, how do you assess the current status of these big banks?
Well, you know, they're in control of the credit creation within our national economy, and it's concentrated, as your lead-in indicated, and they've proven themselves not to be all that trustworthy. I mean, they've already failed. In 2008, they failed, and we bailed them out. And then what happened with the quantitative easing programs was basically a lot of money came into their coffers and was not distributed onto Main Street. So Wall Street was safe, but not Main Street. Meanwhile, what we're seeing in California is there was a report 3 months ago by California Watch, $9 billion over the last 8 years has been taken out in principal by different school districts throughout the state of California. And it's going to be another $26 billion in interest, which is going to be paid. Now, this is primarily to large banks, and that's because they control the credit industry. And if we could control it, we could have funded all the school building and then some in California and basically paid that interest to ourselves.
Wow. That's a good way to look at it, and it's rarely framed that way.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem is epidemic. We just don't recognize it as such. Another example is the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. You know, that's $6 billion in materials and services. It's another $6 billion in interest. We could have paid that to ourselves.
And Timothy, what would you add to this? I mean, 5 years after the crash, these banks are even bigger, and they know, basically, is this correct in your mind, that if we have another crash, and a lot of people say that we might, they will most likely be bailed out again?
I think so. There's been plenty of studies done that show that these big banks get an implicit subsidy from the market, that their cost of raising capital is lower, and the reason for that is that the market itself believes that these banks will be bailed out by the federal government should there be another crisis. And when you analyze the Dodd-Frank legislation, there's nothing in there that really ties the hands of the Federal Reserve from engaging in all kinds of supports for the financial markets and for financial institutions. You know, still we have in the past 4 or 5 years now, the Federal Reserve has had several so-called quantitative easing programs, by which they simply purchase trillions of dollars of financial instruments, mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds, from these large banks. Essentially, that's the way the transaction works, and that's certainly one support of these financial institutions, even short of a bailout.
In 2011, January 2011, Bloomberg ran a piece called Secret Fed Loans Gave Banks $13 Billion Undisclosed to Congress.
Oh, that's $13 trillion, actually.
Oh, well, it says B here. Maybe they made a mistake.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think that there were $13 trillion in loans.
So I think this one is about... I think it's an undisclosed report that they got their hands on, but the overall total is $13 trillion, right?
Yes, yes.
And so what is the status of that money? Has all of it been paid back? Oh, I mean, where is that money?
I don't know if there's been an audit that has focused on whether or to what degree those funds have been paid back. Those $13 trillion were in the form of very short-term, extremely low-interest loans to the banks. So they wouldn't be that difficult for the banks to pay back because of the interest rate. You know, Elizabeth Warren has, Senator Warren has recently introduced legislation to try to give student debtors the same kind of interest rate that these big banks are getting. The kind of interest rate the Fed has been charging to these banks has been very close to zero.
So when we look at this banking system, Mark, what has changed since the crisis?
Wow, it's hard. I'm hard pressed to say what has changed. I think that what's happened is that these banks have gotten larger relative to our GDP. Their asset size is much higher than it was 10 plus years ago. So it's even more concentrated in terms of wealth, and so the risk is higher. So I guess that's what's changed.
Tim, can you come up with any major changes? Or
no,
even minor
really,
changes?
I think the derivatives markets, which is really this kind of a casino economy, continue without very much transparency. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission has been hard-pressed to try to write some rules to bring this this type of casino economy under regulation, and they haven't gotten very far in it so far because of a lot of resistance by the banks. So... I'm not so sure that much has changed. You could see that the Fed has pumped an awful lot of liquidity into the system, as I mentioned, these quantitative easing programs. And as a result, not much has changed as a result. The banks haven't turned around and started opening their lending spigots to Main Street and small businesses, which is part of the reason that the economy is still growing very slowly, and that there's still so much high unemployment. So it really is a trickle-down type of monetary policy right now, where the Fed tries to push monetary reserves into the banking system, but the banking system is sitting on nearly $2 trillion of excess reserves that they end up parking at the Federal Reserve anyway, rather than lending out those funds.
Do you see any possibility of these banks being broken up into smaller ones in the future, especially if there's another crash?
Well, I think that there's a lot more recognition that this is what needs to be done, both among some politicians in Washington and certainly, you mentioned Gretchen Morgenson and a number of economists, Simon Johnson and others, have been talking about this pretty consistently. So there's perhaps more recognition out there that this would be the kind of solution that would be needed. But I just worry that when push comes to shove, if there's another financial crisis, Wall Street would send their army of lobbyists up to Capitol Hill and, that things maybe would not change and that they would not be broken up. But, it really is a cartel that you've described when six big banks control two-thirds of the nation's assets.
Senator Elizabeth Warren gets the most publicity because she's one of the few, other than Bernie Sanders and maybe a couple of others, that regularly speak out on this issue. Tim, do you think that she'll have much power given the way the system works?
She has her own type of bully pulpit, you could say. When she speaks, I think the press does listen. The blogosphere understands what she's trying to do. But she's really one of 100 senators, and I'm not so sure she's going to be able to, you know, win the fight for the consumer when so many in her own party are still playing ball with the big banks.
That is Tim Canova. He's professor of law and public finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We're also joined by Mark Armstrong, executive director of the Public Banking Institute, a nonprofit that facilitates the implementation of public banking at all levels. And we're talking about alternatives to the two big-to-fail institutions. There are now six. They're even bigger than they were before the recession. Collectively, they hold $9.4 trillion in assets. And a lot of people say that we need to look to public banks to get out of this mess. So, Mark, public banks, you know, there was the huge Move Your Money campaign. Move your money from the big banks to the community banks. Give us sort of an overview of public banking. What is public banking exactly?
Well, what public banking is basically state or county ownership of a depository bank. There's really only one depositor in those banks, and that would be the state or county. So it's essentially the government, the state government, for instance, California, owning its own bank and depositing all of the tax revenue and fee revenue into it instead of putting it into these Wall Street banks. You know, you were asking earlier about breaking up the Wall Street banks, and this is actually a way to break it up. When you add all the deposits up, over the course of time, it's well over $1 trillion. And so if public governments, state and county governments, took that $1 trillion plus away from those Wall Street banks, put it in their own banks at a distributed level, we'd end up with a network of public banks that's transparent, that's accountable, that can publish things like LIBOR equivalents. We all know about the LIBOR scandal from last summer. Well, there's no reason why we can't have a LIBOR equivalent determined by the public banking network. You know, and that would be a lot more accountable, a lot more fair than what's going on in England right now. So a public bank is simply applying good governance to the concept of a government-owned bank and actually putting controls in place so that the credit that's generated is not misused. So, for instance, in North Dakota, what they do is they put their tax revenues in their own bank, but they don't let the politicians lend it out. It's run by bankers, and they actually partner with their 110 community banks in North Dakota, which could be done in Sonoma County or Alameda or San Francisco, but they partner with those community banks and have those community banks extend these loan programs to Main Street businesses.
And when did this start in North Dakota? How did they get a public bank?
Yeah, it started 90-plus years ago in 1919, and the reason why was very similar to what's going on right now. Basically, the farmers were being were not able to sell a lot of their grain. It was mostly an agricultural economy at that point, to the railroads. The railroads controlled the mills, and so the out-of-state banks foreclosed on the farmers, and what happened was that it was the railroads who bought all the land for pennies on the dollar. And the farmer said, well, enough of this. We're gonna have our own bank in order to extend credit to ourselves. And so they took matters in their own hands. And so they've got a very powerful bank that is serving the interests of the people. To give you an idea, their state budget is $4.8 billion for the state of North Dakota. Their bank has $5 billion plus in assets.
Wow.
I mean, imagine the an equivalent-sized bank in the state of California or just a county. You know, we could basically double the effectiveness of our state or county budgets by building up the asset base in a publicly owned bank.
And Tim, what would you add to that? What do we need to know about how a public bank actually works and how it would affect, well, not only local economies, but the entire state?
Well, I think there are a number of types of public banks, and I think Mark is very right to focus on the Bank of North Dakota as one very important model, a state-chartered, state-owned, essentially a commercial bank. There are other types of public banks, I think, that would complement this approach, and that would include state-owned infrastructure banks, which are notoriously underfunded and, I think, serving the interest of private finance more than the public interest in building infrastructure and financing work projects, public sector infrastructure jobs. And then lastly, I would and I should say that type of infrastructure model has been used pretty successfully, I'm saying public infrastructure banks, by countries as varied as Germany and China. And I would add to that, of course, the elephant in the room, which is that the central bank itself, the Federal Reserve, should be a publicly owned and directed central bank, and it is not. Its ownership is in private hands. Its direction is a hybrid, which leaves private financial moneyed interests very much in the pilot seat and in control of the central bank. And as a result, I think the central bank's monetary policy gets skewed very much towards private interests and away from the public interest.
And that is Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at the Nova Southeastern University Shepherd Broad Law Center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Mark Armstrong is Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute. From June 2nd to the 4th, a public banking conference will be held in San Rafael, focusing on how to reclaim the economy from Wall Street with public banking. And if you've got any questions about public banking, we'd love to hear from you. Again, there is a public bank in North Dakota. And there are 20 states considering some form of state banking legislation, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. So what questions do you have about public banking? We've done a couple of shows about the Move Your Money campaign. And just overall on banking, because this doesn't really get that much attention, the banks are hardly on the front pages anymore. What questions do you have about the banking system 5 years after the economic crisis? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Mark, did the Move Your Money campaign make a big impact, do you think?
Well, it did. I know that there were thousands of new accounts opened up in small credit unions and community banks. I don't know the number in terms of what was transferred, but it was a significant number, and so that's great. But I know I've been working with some of the Move Your Money different campaign organizers, and their goal this past year was to move $1 billion, and that's a noble goal, but we're looking at moving $1 trillion of deposits, because the public governments basically deposit huge amounts of money in these banks. What's happened with public finance is it's been completely privatized. Mm. And we're talking about huge amounts of deposits, whether it's taxes or fees or investments or whatever. And so that's basically all been put into private banks, and so we just want to move a good portion of that tax revenue back into these depository banks, which would be public.
So elaborate on that. What would that look like?
Well, it would actually scale in terms of the size of the community. So, for instance, Sonoma County, where I live, has a similar population to North Dakota. It's at nearly 600,000. North Dakota is approaching 800,000. And our GDP in Sonoma County was $20 billion this past year. North Dakota's was $40 billion. So let's say we opened up a $1 billion bank. Now, keep in mind, North Dakota's is a lot larger, but they have state income tax and other things, whereas Sonoma County Treasurer does not have access to those funds. So that would be on the smaller end. A state-owned bank for California could be in the tens of billions of dollars, that kind of size. It would be one of the largest banks in the world. And so just in California, there could be all sorts of county-owned banks, a city-owned bank in San Francisco, as well as a state-owned bank. They could all have different focuses, too. The state-owned bank could be focused perhaps on generating student loans for people to attend the universities here in California. And the locally owned banks, the public banks at the county level, could be more focused on jobs programs. Keep in mind, in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota, for every $100,000 that is lent, it's required that at least one new job is created. So they fuse their public policy jobs program with their bank. It's really an innovative way of approaching that issue.
And what is the status of starting a public bank in California? There's a bill, Assembly Bill 750, introduced by Ben Hueso, Assemblyman of San Diego. Do you know the status of that?
Right. That was introduced a year and a half ago, and it actually passed both houses and went to Governor Jerry Brown's desk, and he pocket vetoed it and returned it back to the Assembly. Unfortunately, it was just to do a study for what a state-owned bank could be doing with its credit. Again, we're talking about billions upon billions of credit, dollars of credit, which could be used to further the public interest, and Governor Brown did return that bill.
So this is would have created basically a task force to look at how this would work. Why did he return the bill? Was there a statement or anything?
His statement was that we have plenty of capacity to do this analysis in-house, but then it was not done.
So is the state at all looking at public banking?
No, Assemblyman Hueso, who's now a state senator, he introduced a full-on state banking bill, but it was withdrawn when it was supposed to go in front of the Assembly Banking and Finance Committee. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure not to focus on banking and finance reform in the form of a public bank in California. Both parties get it. And so this is one of these things, ideas, which has really got to be at the populist level. And frankly, I think we'll be much more successful at the county level, which is where we're putting a lot of our efforts in throughout the country.
So they're feeling the pressure from the large six financial institutions.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, you know, we've got a number of callers, but I'd love to talk more about that after the break. Let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
My understanding is that the FDIC does not have to keep such a large percentage of the amount that it theoretically covers on hand. It's like 1.27% or something like that. Maybe you could clarify that. And it doesn't seem to me that a small amount of money could cover that $9 trillion that in assets, in our money, that the large banks are keeping. So I wondered if you could comment on that, and perhaps you had exact figures about how much the FDIC actually has.
Okay, thank you. Tim, can you take that one?
Well, there are two different reserves, I think, that the caller is perhaps referring to. One is the reserves that the banks themselves, the private banks, have to hold against their deposits. And that figure has varied over the years. It's set by the Federal Reserve Board. But then there's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which, of course, regulates not just regulates, but insures those deposits. And I believe that the Federal Deposit Insurance Fund has its own reserve requirement that is only 1.35% at this time, which means the FDIC needs to maintain only 1.35% of the estimated insured deposits in reserve. So I believe that would be the numbers that this caller was referring to.
And the number, the absolute number is $26 billion they have in reserves.
Okay, that sounds right. Sure.
Okay, well, thank you for the question, Eileen. And we're going to take a quick break. And we've got a number of questions about public banking and what this would actually mean, especially in a state like California. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about public banking, there's a public bank right now in North Dakota. 20 states are considering some form of banking legislation. And as Mark Armstrong just told us, there was a bill last year that would have started a blue ribbon task force to consider the viability of creating a California state bank. But Jerry Brown sent the bill back, so essentially let it die. And so that's where we are right now in California. We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have, and what sort of viable alternative does public bank offer? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Josh Fox about his new film, Gasland 2. This is a sequel to Gasland, which explores how the fracking industry has changed people's lives, their health, and how the government is or is not responding. So you'll definitely want to tune in for that tomorrow. And then Thursday, we'll have a conversation about another film called Rebels with a Cause. It is about passionate people in California who saved the coastal wonders that would eventually become the Point Reyes National Seashore and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And Rebels with a Cause will be the kickoff film for this year's San Francisco Green Film Festival. So we'll talk about what we can learn from those amazing activists who fought for open space. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the banking system. This doesn't get the attention it deserves, but 5 years after the crisis, the system is dominated by six too-big-to-fail institutions. They're even bigger today than they were before the crash. Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup. Collectively, they hold $9.4 trillion in assets. The bailout was $13 trillion. That's important to mention. So we're talking about alternatives, and a lot of people say we need to look to public banking. There's a public bank in North Dakota. 20 states are considering some form of state banking legislation. And we're joined by Mark Armstrong, Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute. From June 2nd to the 4th, a public banking conference will take place in San Rafael. It'll focus on how to reclaim the economy from Wall Street with public banking. We're also joined by Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And we've got one line open if you'd like to join us. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Mark, Jackie has a question about California. Since the state keeps running a deficit, she says, how in the world would we have anything in our bank?
Okay, so that's a great question. I come across that all the time. So there are plenty of ways to capitalize the bank. Let me just give you one of them. There's a unclaimed property fund throughout the country. It adds up to over $32 billion. In the state of California, the California share of that $32 billion is about $5 or $6 billion. It was about five or six 2 years ago. Now the state controller has to prudently invest that $5 or $6 billion. Now, keep in mind, these are life insurance proceeds. These are different things that insurance companies have paid out, but nobody's claimed them. And so, this is liquid money, and it needs to be prudently invested. He just can't put it under a mattress. We could have taken $5 billion and capitalized the bank by having a state Bank of California issue a corporate bond, which the state controller could have used that money to invest in. Now, keep in mind, in the state of North Dakota, the return on equity for the Bank of North Dakota has been anywhere from 17.5% to over 26% for the last 5 years, actually for the last 6 years. It just every year it provides an excellent return on equity. We could have taken a small portion of that and returned it back to the unclaimed property fund and used the rest to keep capitalizing the bank. So that's just one example. There are plenty of other examples where money is sloshing around the system, which could have been used to fund it, to capitalize a publicly owned bank.
And Timothy, what would you add to that?
I don't really have anything to add to that. I think Mark is absolutely right. The funds are there. The resources are there. It shouldn't be that difficult to capitalize a California state bank. And by the same token, I've been calling for California to start shifting its deposits from private banks to some portion of it into the California State Infrastructure and Economic Development Bank. You know, the Governor Brown, has been resistant to any kinds of reforms along those lines. I think part of the reason has been who the governor named to be his jobs czar, and one of his top economic advisors is a former Bank of America top executive. Mm.
Well, and also I was just looking at bank lobbying, and we're going to get some numbers about how much the bank lobby spends in California and in D.C. We've got a few listeners who say, can we step back a little bit and basically go over public banking 101? Because some people are a little confused about what this is exactly. So, Timothy, can you again give us sort of an, you know, what are the main differences between, like, in San Francisco, we've got Bank of America's on every corner. What's the difference between a Bank of America and, say, if, you know, California started a public bank? What would be the main differences?
Let's say a public bank that was modeled on the Bank of North Dakota, and I think Mark might be able to add a lot more to this than my understanding of the Bank of North Dakota. But my understanding is that the Bank of North Dakota is managed far differently than a bank like Bank of America, that its executives are paid a much more prudent type of salaries. They don't get these outsized bonuses for taking enormous risks with depositor money, and that the earnings, the profits from the Bank of North Dakota flow back to the taxpayer. I think North Dakota has been the only state in the union that has not suffered a deficit since the financial crisis of 2008. And over the last decade, and this is a small state, North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota has sent over $300 million back to the state treasury, I believe the numbers are. So, you know, it really is a question of whose interest is the bank being operated in? Is it for the gains of very few people at the very top of a private financial institution, or a public bank where the benefits would be far more widespread? There'd be more loans to middle class and small business interests, and there wouldn't be the kinds of use of depositor money to be gambling in the derivatives markets.
Who makes the decisions at North Dakota's public bank?
Well, my understanding is they have a management team, but the management team is really inherently much more accountable to the state, precisely because it's a state-owned bank.
And Mark, what would you add to that in terms of the major differences between a Bank of America and a state-owned bank?
Well, the key thing that's similar is they both have access to low cost of deposits. So what Tim was talking about earlier in terms of access to funds from the Federal Reserve at 0.7% or whatever it may be, it's a fairly low rate. That's exactly the same type of access the Bank of North Dakota has. And it borrows quite a bit of money every day from the Federal Reserve network of private banks. So that's similar, but it's very different in terms of how it's operated. It is not a retail bank. The Bank of North Dakota is simply a bank which is, you could say it's a bank on paper. Of course, there's a building, but in any other county or state, it could just operate out of some cubicles in an administrative office. And the whole intent is to generate loan programs which serve the needs of the people. So in our conference that's coming up next week, the title of it is Funding the New Economy. We view public banks as being critical to actually package this public credit into loan programs which fund co-ops, which fund, you know, solar energy businesses, which fund sustainable agriculture for local production of food. You can go down the list of the different types of businesses that people want to start on Main Street, but they're not getting the loans to do it from Wall Street banks.
And right now there are 20 bills around the country that would start public banks?
Yeah, in one form or another. The states which are probably most advanced in terms of their understanding and pushing forward this concept is both the state of Maine as well as Vermont, typically low population states. We are finding a lot of counties in the outside of Philadelphia area as well as the city of Philadelphia considering a public bank, and we suspect that it may happen at the more local level where the decision making is just a few people, not you don't get into the politics like you do with the state of California.
And according to Yes Magazine, over a 15-year period, the bank in North Dakota has contributed more to the state budget than oil taxes have.
Right. Keep in mind that the Bank of North Dakota has been profitable since 1972. Every year it's been running a profit, and this has nothing to do with oil. And so when you add all that up, you know, that's a lot of money that's being directed back to the state. Keep in mind that what the Bank of North Dakota does is fund two things. It funds its infrastructure, and it also funds commercial loans. Those are the two main buckets of money that it spends its money on. And if you just look at infrastructure, and again, going back to the Bay Bridge, you know, we're forced into borrowing money from private investment funds or banks and then paying them interest. The state of North Dakota has no general obligation bonds whatsoever. And they purposely do that because they can fund infrastructure through their own bank. It's just a smart way to use public credit.
Well, I hope that answers more questions. And if you have any more specifically about public banking and how this would operate, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you have general questions just about the banking system in general and what...
If I could just add, Timothy. I've spoken to a state senator in Maryland who was a sponsor of Maryland's public banking bill. And he was also a sponsor of the bill to abolish the death penalty in Maryland. And he said that the public banking bill gave him more grief than anything else he's ever done as a state senator because of the backlash from the private banking lobbyists. So you get an idea why it's so difficult. This is an idea which should not be controversial. It's clearly in the public interest. It's not going to drive private banks out of business, and it would do an awful lot of public good. But the private banking lobbies circle the wagons every time. They oppose this model as a mortal threat because they know when people see that public banking works and it would be how successful it is in North Dakota and would be elsewhere, that's why the private bankers circle the wagons and try to prevent it from happening.
Well, we're still looking at lobbying in D.C. and in California, and we'll bring those numbers to you in a minute. But the New York Times recently reported, actually just May 20th, so just a couple days ago, that the Security Industry and Financial Markets Association just announced that Judd Gregg, a former Republican senator from New Hampshire, will be running their lobbying group, for which he will be paid $3 million. So,
why am I not surprised?
Yeah, well, we'll get those numbers for you in a minute. But we're talking today about public banking with Mark Armstrong, Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute. They're funding the New Economy Conference, kicks off June 2nd in San Rafael. You can find more information. Rolling Stone reporter Matt Taibbi will be speaking. Who else is speaking at this conference, Mark?
Well, Timothy is as well. He's going to be talking on Monday. He'll be talking about the Federal Reserve. We also have Birgitta Jonsdottir, who's a parliamentarian from Iceland. She founded the Pirate Party in Iceland, and three members of the Pirate Party were elected just 3 weeks ago. And Ellen Brown, of course, author of Web of Debt. She's got a new book called The Public Banking Solution, which will be out in 2 weeks. And Gar Alperovitz is going to be one of the speakers as well, founder of the Democracy Collaborative. He's very much into cooperatives, and cooperatives are a great example of a type of business, a new ownership model, which could be funded easily with a public bank. The risk actually is lower with cooperatives because everybody's invested in it. They're investing their time and effort. And because of that, you end up with this ownership by all the people, not just a single person. And yet they're being starved for credit. So a public bank can actually fund that. So we'll be talking about all these different topics, including the post office bank. Jim Sauber with the National Association of Letter Carriers will be speaking on Tuesday morning. There are some really significant developments with the whole idea of providing banking services in our post offices.
And that conference kicks off June 2nd to the 4th. Is there a fee for that?
Yes. The information is at publicbanking.org. The conference itself is $295, but really people can attend the event on Sunday night with Matt Taibbi and Birgitta, and that's just $35.
Okay.
We also have a free event on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Forum. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is really declaring war on a number of things, including any sort of buy local initiative by government entities.
So, really?
Yes. When you look at the Buy American sentiment that many people have, that will be prohibited from government procurement contracts because of TPP. So we've got a TPP forum on Monday night, and that's free for the public. So Monday night is free, Sunday night is $35, more information at publicbanking.org.
And we are doing a show about that partnership, I think next Tuesday, but definitely in the next couple of weeks. Well, we've got full lines, so let's take a couple callers, and then we'll get responses from Mark and Tim. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. You've covered a great deal, and perhaps it's more than I can comprehend. So I want to just focus in on a particular thing that you said, because it raised a question in my mind. You said that the state bank earns 17%, that's the return that it's able to earn. And you said that, as I understood at any rate, that they lend to cooperatives and other commercial things that benefit the public. Now, my question is, if they can earn 17%, why aren't the private banks investing in the same things? Because there are very few investments that you can earn 17% on.
That's a good question. There's something that's going on with the Bank of North Dakota, which is a bit of a head scratcher. They actually say that they're investing in riskier investments, and they say that on paper. But the reality is that they have a lower loan loss write-off rate than private banks. It's like 0.22%. So even though they're saying that they're taking on riskier investments, it's not being reflected in the numbers, as you indicated. And so I think there's this perception which just doesn't match reality. The private bankers and in this case, Bank of North Dakota, say that something may be riskier, but the reality is that it's coming through nicely.
All right.
Tim, can you add to that, perhaps?
Tim?
No, I think that's right on.
Okay, great. Thank you, William. Let's go next to Andrew in San Francisco. Hi, Andrew.
Yeah, hi there. My understanding is of how banks fail is that the bets or loans that they've made go bad. I guess my first question is what would that look like if people are for thinking that may be something that were the economy or the is vulnerable, or how it's vulnerable, I guess, is my question. And then if it is a systemic type of problem, wouldn't that affect state-owned banks as well? Thank you.
So this really comes back to the type of loans that are being made. And let's talk about really conservative loans. Let's talk about school districts in California. Because the school districts are unwilling to raise taxes or cut services, they actually have to go out and raise money through bonds. And so they've been issuing capital appreciation bonds, which has been able to raise over $9 billion in principal the last 8 years. But you don't have to pay this for the next 20 to 30 years plus. And so you end up having to pay another $26 billion in interest, so 26 plus the $9 billion in principal. So that's our starting point. It would just make much more sense to finance that $9 billion with loans generated from a public bank, and then whatever interest is charged is paid back to the people who own the bank, which are the taxpayers. And so it doesn't have to be a risky investment at all. We're not talking about commercial loans at all. We're just talking about building school buildings and funding it through the normal rate of collection of taxes and such and fees. So you don't have to introduce risk into the equation at all with a loan portfolio like that.
All right. Thank you for the call, Andrew. Let's hear next from Tom in San Francisco. Hi, Tom.
Yes. Is there anything in the near future that is trying to restrict the ability for communities to create their own community banks or state banks or public banks? Is there some type of restriction trying to be in place?
Well, yeah, the restriction is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. They are including financial services within the umbrella of this agreement. It's like NAFTA on steroids. But because financial services are included, then that means that any publicly owned bank that's offering below market rates. Now keep in mind, Bank of North Dakota offers below market rates of 1 or 2%. That would be prohibited from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. So yeah, that's being worked on right now, and President Obama is trying to fast track this fall.
And again, the talks on this latest free trade agreement are all taking place behind closed doors, right?
Right, right. There's no, all we're working off of are leaked draft agreements.
So given what we're dealing with, I mean, we can't even get a blue ribbon task force here in California. What can we do if those of us think that public banking is a good idea? How can we fight for it?
Well, I think the way to do it is to take our deposits back. Those deposits are public deposits. You know, our county treasurers are putting those public deposits into private banks. And the core concept behind a public bank, the public banking movement, is to take public revenues, put them into public banks, and use it for the public good. And it's very, very clear. And so, you know, the pressure needs to be put on county treasurers and county supervisors to create their own banks. Keep in mind, creating a bank is not a difficult thing. It's simply a corporation that has a banking license. And there are plenty of banks that are going under in the state of California, and it's easy to purchase their banking license. It's very much like a liquor license. You can buy ownership of a bar that already has a liquor license and obtain it that way. And so the challenge is to build a set of assets which are conservative and which generate the returns that you need in order to pay off your depositors. So you need to have professional bankers run it, but the idea of starting one is not that difficult.
I'd like to just add that some of the opposition often tries to point to state statutory provisions and sometimes constitutional language at the state level that may prohibit a state from giving or lending on the credit of the state, making loans on the credit of the state. And it's really a distortion of the statutory language and the intent of the legislature. When the state or counties deposit funds in a private bank, they're not making loans, they're depositors. So there should really be no difference in treatment when they shift those deposits or a portion of them to publicly owned banks.
And according to WallStreetWatch.org, the financial sector has about 415 lobbyists compared to the accounting sector, which has about 178 lobbyists. And over the past decade, they have spent more than $5 billion in political influence. That's over the last decade, $5 billion. So thanks again for calling in, Tom. And we've got just a couple minutes left. Let's go to Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate this show. It seems like this is the most important thing we could do as a citizenry to change things. And it seems like sometimes we're being held hostage by being afraid that we would get a worse politician than Jerry Brown. I mean, I used to think Jerry Brown was a good guy, but you know, I'm starting to wonder because of a lot of things he's doing. But just some of the things Obama is doing to protect bankers, and it's so obvious, yet we keep hearing, you know, not hearing that we need, I don't know, I guess I would just like to get some ideas of what we as a citizenry can do, you know, threaten impeachment or whatever, but how can we get that rolling if there are any suggestions? You know, I do call Congress people, and I do think it has an effect, but...
Yeah, well, that's the question of the day, right? Well, thank you for calling in. Timothy, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, given what we're facing, what's the most effective approach we can take?
My view is that there's not going to be any fundamental change in Washington, at least, and that's where a lot of change has to occur. There's not going to be any fundamental change there as long as both of these political parties are so heavily influenced by private moneyed interests, by Wall Street interests. And I say this as somebody who's, until recently, been a lifelong Democrat. I worked on Capitol Hill for the late U.S. Senator Paul Tsongas. But I must say that I despair at the lack of reform under Democrats when they controlled the White House and when they had for 2 years controlled both houses of Congress. I do think there needs to be a real serious discussion as to why there is not a third-party movement that represents the interests of the 99% in this country. What are the barriers to starting a new party? This country is facing a crisis like it has not in many, many decades. And you can look back in past history of this country when there have been major crises, and they have bred third-party movements, either successful ones like the Republican Party that took power with Abraham Lincoln, or less successful ones that still managed to push the policy debate in a more progressive direction.
So do you see any changes at all under this administration? I mean, it's been interesting to watch some of his appointees. They're being confirmed as we speak.
I think it's a very incremental approach. My own view, I know it departs a little bit from just speaking narrowly about banking, but to put it into a context, I believe we are in a jobs depression. The economy lost millions of jobs during the financial crisis, during the collapse. And it's been gaining back the jobs at an incredibly slow pace of only 100 to 200,000 jobs a month when there's many, many millions who are looking for work and can't find work. Just the size of the discouraged workforce that have given up on looking for jobs because they're not there. And, you know, to look at this as a depression and not a recession, I think is what we should be doing.
Well,
in the 1930s, it was the Great Depression, and it was not a recession. The economy was growing even quicker than it is today. But it was a depression because so many people were out of work, consumers were underwater, and the Roosevelt administration approached it as a depression and had work and relief programs. And that's not happened under the Obama administration. You know, the point of public banking should be in part to provide loans to the private sector, small businesses, and the middle class, but it should also be to facilitate public projects. And, you know, how many more bridges have to collapse? You know, there's a need for infrastructure investment. There's a need for public sector jobs programs to be building that infrastructure. And yet the banking system, there's not an adequate public banking system. There's not adequate funding from Congress.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, but we will definitely continue following this. Tim Canova is professor of law and public finance in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Mark Armstrong is executive director of the Public Banking Institute. Funding the New Economy Conference kicks off June 2nd in San Rafael. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Now that fracking is receiving widespread attention, how are communities responding? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Josh Fox about his new film, Gasland 2, a sequel that explores how the fracking industry has changed people's lives and how governments are responding. How have organized citizens successfully stood in the way of fracking? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.